This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The first of several trials related to the historic public corruption probe that has netted Honolulu's top brass and prosecutors launched this week. Honolulu Civil Beats reporter Nick Ruby joins us from the federal building, where he's been covering the opening statements and the first witnesses on the stand. Morning, Nick.
Aloha, Catherine. Thanks for having me on.
Yes, so I've been reading your stories, and one of the first witnesses you have on is with a homicide detective.
Yeah, so homicide detective Drew Akagi was on the witness stand yesterday, which was the second day of testimony in the Ke Aloha trial. And his testimony is significant because it shows that after the Ke Aloha's mailbox was stolen in June 2013, two of the top detectives in all of HPD were assigned, and that was Drew Akagi and his partner. And what Detective Akagi said when he first received the assignment is, hey, why is this case coming to us? It seems like it might be a bit of a conflict to have us investigate the theft of the police chief's mailbox. He was worried about the idea of whether they could in fact, be impartial. He said, of course, that he and his partner were impartial, but it raised questions about the overall investigation. Well, at least that's what the prosecutors are hoping.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that would be kind of a reasonable question to ask.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think one of the ways that the defense tried to counter that, and they've done this as well with some of the other officers who were involved with the investigation from the Criminal Intelligence Unit, is by raising questions, hopefully in the jurors' minds, about the fact that this was a crime in which the police chief was an alleged victim. And if that's the case, wouldn't you want to have some of your best officers on the case, as it were, whether it's homicide detectives or the Criminal Intelligence Unit, which, of course, is this secret police unit of officers who conduct surveillance and investigate organized crime and suspected terrorism.
Right, and at the heart of this case is this whole frame-up issue of whether the Ke Alohas were framing Gerald Puana.
That's right, yeah. The federal government, in its case, is trying to say that Louis Ke Aloha and Catherine Ke Aloha framed Gerard Puana for the theft of their mailbox in 2013 in an attempt to undermine him in a civil lawsuit he had filed against Mrs. Ke Aloha. They, of course, used the help of Honolulu police officers who were involved with this, the Criminal Intelligence Unit, to help them carry out that alleged frame job, according to the DOJ. And really, that's what the government's trying to do. Is they're trying to prove that this was some big mass conspiracy to take out Mr. Puana. The defense, of course, is saying, listen, that's a far-fetched conspiracy theory. They're saying that the government's conspiracy allegations are nothing more than a conspiracy theory. It's requiring a lot of leaps of faith to show that these officers were all coordinating and acting to take out Gerard Puana for this alleged mailbox theft. And really all they have to do is raise a little bit of reasonable doubt in the minds of some of these jurors in order to be successful in this case.
And we've all seen the video clip, the surveillance clip, and I guess at the heart of that is really, you know, was it Gerald or not?
Yeah, and that's actually a major point in this trial today and as well as yesterday. So Drew Akagi, the homicide detective, said, you know, he had no idea who it was in that video, and he couldn't really pick the person out because it's a black and white surveillance video and really grainy, so it's really hard to see the details on the face of the officer, of the person in the doing the alleged mailbox stuff. But he relied on Catherine Ke Aloha's identification of that person. She said it was Gerard Puana. That's what made him say, all right, we can go arrest this guy. Today we have the person who made that arrest, Nale Sa'oto, on the stand, and he said the same thing. When he watched the video, he couldn't recognize who that person was. He had no idea who it was. Of course, he didn't know Gerard Puana at the time. When he went out to make the arrest, he had a photo of Gerard Puana that was given to him to make that arrest. In 2017, however, when Nale Sa'oto was living in Seattle and working in law enforcement there, he said an FBI agent showed up and said, hey, we're hearing rumors that you're the guy who stole the Kealoha's mailbox. And he said, no, it absolutely wasn't me. He watched the video again with this FBI agent and said, there's no way that can be me. I know that's not me. And that's when one of the prosecutors today asked him if he would be able to recognize that person as Gerard Puana, and he said no.
Yeah, and apparently what Gerard Puana's sister didn't recognize that person as her brother.
That's right. Gerard Puana's older sister was on the witness stand yesterday, and she said the guy in the video definitely wasn't her brother. She said that for a number of reasons. One of them, the guy in the video looked much younger than her 50-something-year-old brother and a lot more athletic. Her brother, of course, is a weightlifter and a powerlifter, but she said he has a really short, stout neck, almost to the point where he doesn't have a neck. The person in the video looks athletic or had an athletic build. Another thing that really stuck out to her was the fact that the person in the video stealing the mailbox was wearing a baseball cap. She said Gerard Puana hardly ever wears hats, mostly because he just likes the way his hair looks.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much, Nick. I'm sure it's going to be just interesting, from day to day. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks so much, Catherine. Appreciate it.
That was reporter Nick Gruby with today's Reality Check. He is back in Honolulu to cover this historic trial. To follow the coverage, visit civilbeat.org. You know, at one point in the week leading up to this first of three trials, it appeared that Hawaii News Now investigative reporter Lynn Kawano would be called in as a witness in the trial, a move that Kawano described as an effort to keep her from covering the case. In the end, she was crossed off that list, but the incident got us curious about what happens when members of the media get tangled up in the criminal justice system. Jeffrey Portnoy is a First Amendment attorney and University of Hawaii regent. He spoke with HPR's Ryan Finnerty about how journalists are or aren't protected from judicial action.
Well, there's no statute and there's no guidelines. There are some court decisions that make it very clear that a reporter, even if one could establish they have a qualified privilege not to have to testify on certain matters, for example, unpublished material or the identity of sources, the opposite is equally true, which is a reporter who witnesses a crime is required to testify as to what he or she has witnessed. So if they are a witness to a criminal act, they have no protection. If they are reporting on a crime, they may very well have certain protections.
And where do those protections stem from? What are some of the relevant cases?
Some states have shield laws. We used to have one in Hawaii, but due to the wisdom, quote unquote, of our legislature, they allowed it to expire. So we have no shield law. All we have is case law that is established by various courts around the country, federal and state courts. So in Hawaii, it's a little bit unclear because we don't have the shield law anymore that articulates by statute when and under what circumstances a reporter can be compelled or not compelled to testify. So we've had some case law over the years, and there's what's called a three-part test. But essentially, a reporter can be potentially compelled to testify if the party seeking that testimony essentially has exhausted all other opportunities and methods to get that testimony, and it is absolutely critical to the case. But it also depends on whether it's grand jury, whether it's criminal, or whether it's civil, because the reporter has more protections in civil than they do in criminal, and in criminal protections than they do in grand jury.
Now, what about a case where a reporter has been working with a confidential source, and they're called as a witness and asked to name that source?
Yeah. Again, this is going to depend on the whim of a judge, but it's really very factually dependent. I'm sure the reporter will fight it strenuously and will argue that they have a privilege not to disclose a confidential source. And I'm sure a prosecutor or a defense lawyer will argue that there is no such privilege anymore in Hawaii. And that under the circumstances, again, that they can't get the information anywhere else and that it's critical to the case. So it's really up to of the decision of the judge as to whether they would order the reporter to reveal the name of the sources. I will tell you, you know, 99% of reporters will not reveal the name of a source unless absolutely forced to. Some even go to prison rather than reveal the name of a source.
And that's what was going to be my next question. What are the potential consequences of not revealing a source or failing to comply?
Well, it depends on the situation. If it's a defamation case, for example, then the court can find that you had no source, which essentially means you're going to lose the case and lose a lot of money. If it's a criminal case, the sanction is they could hold the reporter in contempt, and then if the reporter continues to refuse to testify, they can either try to get the court to stay the contempt to allow an appeal, or they can put the reporter in jail.
And, Jeff, how about a case where there are confidential documents involved, maybe even something that's classified?
Yeah, same thing. Well, you get into classified, that's a whole other situation as to whether there's national security. I assume we weren't talking about that kind of thing, you know, classified national security documents. That's a whole other situation.
I've read in past cases that generally, as long as the reporter doesn't come by the confidential documents by illicit means, basically if they're given anonymously to that reporter, then that person is not usually held liable for their release. Is that a uniform?
No, well, that's a different story. Now you're talking about what's in the documents and whether the reporter has participated in a crime. Yes, it's true that if a reporter is not complicit in how he or she gets the documents, then they clearly cannot be indicted for a crime. But if they have encouraged someone to steal documents or to go into a computer, then they don't have that protection. If they're innocent recipients, then they're not going to be subject to a penalty for how they got the documents, but they still could be subject to a contempt for not revealing it under certain circumstances.
And you mentioned a shield law earlier. Could you elaborate a little bit more on what that is and what protections
it? It's a statutory scheme that outlines legislative provisions as to when and under what circumstances a journalist, and then you have to define who the journalist is because statutes have lots of different definitions, but will set out when and under what circumstances a reporter has an absolute privilege, a statutory privilege, just like lawyer and client or doctor and patient, not to reveal a source. So it doesn't leave it up to the discretion of a judge other than interpreting whether the reporter falls within one of the statutory exemptions to being forced to testify. We had a wonderful shield law, one of the most journalistic-friendly shield laws in the country. And because there were a couple of legislators who were unhappy with stories written about them, they made sure that the bill died, the statute was not, it sunsetted, and they would not renew it. And so it's very unfortunate. There are still 30-plus states that have some kind of statutory privilege for reporters. We are not one of them.
Are there any high-profile instances in case law or that you've come across, a reporter or a journalist getting into hot water in this sort of way?
Well, yeah. I mean, the last one that I've been about was a long time ago, but Jerry Cotto was going to go to prison in a libel case when we refused and he refused to reveal a source. And the judge was going to send him to prison. And right before he was going to prison, the source decided to come out. But he would have been in prison for a long time because he was never going to reveal. We have been very successful. I have been very successful in working with prosecutors and civil and criminal lawyers in getting almost every attempt to force a reporter to testify resolved without it happening, by threatening to put this into 3 years of litigation, by pointing out what the three-part test is about you haven't exhausted other sources, haven't exhausted other methods of finding out the information. It's not absolutely critical to the case. And we've won three or four of these in court. But, you have a case like Kealoha these cases come across very rarely, and reporters can find themselves right smack in the middle.
Jeff, thanks very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
All right. I hope I answered all your questions.
That was Jeff Portnoy, a First Amendment attorney and a member of the University of Hawaii Board of Regents. He has represented several local news outlets, including Hawaii Public Radio, in past legal action.
Hi, this is DJ Mr. Nick, host of Bridging the Gap. We're teaming up with the Hawaii State Library to take the show out of the studio and into the library. My co-host and I will be taping the show live on May 28th through the 31st from 12 to 2 p.m. at the Hawaii State Library in downtown Honolulu. We'll be pulling music exclusively from their collection and then reshelving it for you to borrow the next day. More information at hawaiipublicradio.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your Aloha Friday quiz.
Unihua, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, uahu, umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe.
Today's Backyard Quiz takes us back in music history. The musical ride throughout Asia and Oceania began in April 1979 in Tokyo and ended May 5th at the Lahaina Civic Center on Maui. One day later, the same artist and band gave a concert on Oahu at the Waikiki Shell. This was the first and only Asia-Pacific tour this beloved reggae artist made, stopping in New Zealand, Japan, Australia, and Hawaii. If you have any knowledge of reggae music, you probably know the name of the musician and his group. So the more challenging question is, what was the 1979 tour called and which album was being promoted? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors, locations, Haleakala Waldorf School, and Honolulu Waldorf School.
A collection of yellow bowls is making its way across the country. You may have heard about it, an art exhibit with a message. HPR's Noe Tanigawa here this morning to tell us all about it. Good morning.
Thanks, Catherine. Well, here's how Setsuko Sato Winchester's Yellow Bowl Project works, okay? She places her handmade yellow tea bowls at sites that are symbolic for immigrant justice. Her work and the photographs then bring attention to the issues of immigration and naturalization. And she visited Honouliuli, that's Hawaii's largest and longest-running camp. She was here last week for that. Now, you know, people know what happened there, right? People of Japanese ancestry were targeted and removed from society through a presidential executive order. That's really important to remember. The justification was national security. And at Honouliuli, by the numbers, 4,000 prisoners of war, and they were pretty much Japanese, Koreans, Okinawans, and a few Italians. There were 2,000 approximately number of Hawaii detainees there at Honouliuli, and about two-thirds of those were American citizens. There were 8 women there, and one thing they had in common was that they all studied the Shinto religion. And we get to 0, and that is the number of people who were ever tried or convicted of any charges there. But what's informative is that 343 people of Japanese ancestry were picked up within a couple of days of Pearl Harbor. And you just think, how were they so efficient about getting these people? A sample detention list had been prepared in 1937. Newspaper chains that were run by Randolph Hearst and others had been promoting a yellow peril kind of hysteria on the continent, and claims of national security took root in that kind of atmosphere.
So by 1941, there were over 800 pieces of legislation, federal, state, and local, written against Asian peoples. While other groups have slowly integrated and become American, you know, whether it's Italians, Germans were not considered American, you know, Italians weren't considered American, Irish were not. But there was never any law that excludes Irish. But there were laws against Black people. There are laws against Asian people. So when it is the law of the land, it's the government that has to go after you, right? The government can't protect you.
That's Setsuko Winchester. Really interesting. She has a degree in journalism, used to work for NPR in Washington. And she just gave a lot of background on the kind of atmosphere there was at that time that would really make you ask yourself, what were people supposed to do? I mean, when they got this order from the Western Defense Command and Fourth Army, it read, "Instructions to all persons of Japanese ancestry. All Japanese persons, both alien and non-alien, will be evacuated from this designated area by 12 noon, Tuesday, April 7th. That's what one of the notices read. And in Hawaii, well, a third of the population was Japanese, so mass incarceration would not have worked too well. Like 90% of the carpenters at that time were Japanese. They couldn't build a barracks for them. So they were really selective about who they took in here in Hawaii, and that made it really scary, and it really kind of changed the social dynamic. You know, I mean, Catherine, what if, here I am sitting next to you, what if one day I'm just gone? Would you kind of wonder what happened and what I had done?
Yes, I just was at a screening. Bar Association did a screening of the film, and then they came for us. And one of the ladies mentioned that she had an aunt that was on her way from Maui, I think, to go to college in St. Louis. And on her way over, she was taken then to an internment camp. So instead of college, she went to a camp.
People were honestly grabbed off the street, and it's really something that comes alive when you hear what they wrote about it, which is what the docents from the Japanese Cultural Center are so good at. We went out there with a couple of their champion docents. Let me tell you, Honouliuli, when you go there, the valley, the sides seem really steep, and it's just covered with haulikoa and stuff all over, and there's a rutted road that you can go in on. You can stand on these concrete slabs there that are the former barracks, the former mess hall, and it's all above Honouliuli Stream. I wanted to let you hear Jane Kurahara, one of the docents, sharing from Jack Yoshikami's memoir. He was picked up, just pulled out of his house after a day at work, and this is what he said about the hearing he faced after his arrest.
Interrogation by the authorities started with various questions about my personal background, eventually ending with the question, "Do you think it is better for Japan to win this war?" If I answered it was better for Japan to win, I would be sent to the detention center as an enemy alien. If I answered I like America to win, they would insistently say, "Don't lie. I know you're really praying for Japan to win."
You forget that those kinds of interrogations happen. We have to ask ourselves what we would do at every turn. I mean, volunteer Betsy Fujii Young led us down to the stream over there and painted the scene of how the camp would have looked all around us. And she shared some inspiring words from former U.S. Secretary of Transportation Norman Mineta.
Norman Mineta says, "This is not about the past. This is about the future, because history has already had the ability to repeat itself. What you are doing here is drawing that line in the sand to say that never again will these things happen to anyone."
Yellow peril, yes.
Yeah. I mean, really, it makes you think out there. They share poems and even a song that was written after somebody had visited out there at Honouliuli. They take people out once a month. You can sign up for this tour, and it really is the only way to visit Honouliuli right now. It's a National Historic Site, which is super cool because the National Park Service, we met a representative this time out there, and they're so behind the sharing of this story and are working right now on the groundwork to make it more available for people. Right now, you can go there through tours with the Japanese Cultural Center. They've also made a curriculum for high school students on this, and they've got a really good education sort of section of their website, as well as a permanent exhibit that's at the Cultural Center on Beretania Street.
Yeah, I know. It's a great site, a learning site. I know there are kids, I think, from MidPack Institute that were out there mapping the area. You know, so it's all a part of the curriculum to keep that history alive, because it is about the future, not so much about the past.
Exactly. You know, it makes me wonder if there are things already happening that are setting the stage for the kinds of things that happened in that time. Oh, and one last thing. You know, it's such a great moment at the end of the visit to be able to walk down to the stream. And in this case, Betsy helped us just place ourselves with the mess hall there and various people's memories. And even a poem was read down there at the stream. And she played a song that someone had written after visiting Honouliuli. We gathered and they passed out rose petals and we tossed them into Honouliuli stream, thinking about the words of Norman Mineta.
Thank you, Noe Tanigawa. Interesting story. That was HPR's Noe Tanigawa. You can check out her features on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bishop Museum. The exhibition Kini Kekua, Transformative Images, explores how the relationships between images and people can change over time, now through September 2nd, bishopmuseum.org.
It's called Operation High Tide. A team of scientists from the University of Hawaii collaborating with other experts, they're working on a project that they expect to be launched into space sometime after October 2020. UH just got word that the team is in the queue to deliver what's called a CubeSat, which is a small research satellite. It's to collect valuable data looking at things like farmland in North America and volcanic activity across the globe. It will collect data for at least a month, though it's designed to stay for about a year in orbit. Rob Wright is the interim director of the Institute of Geophysics and Planetary Science. He talked about the upcoming mission, funded by a $5.5 million grant.
Well, I'm the principal investigator at the University of Hawaii. We then have other investigators at the University of Hawaii from the Institute of Geophysics and Planetology and also from the Space Flight Laboratory. Space Flight Laboratory is a collaboration between my institute and then also the College of Engineering at the University of Hawaii. So we have a large internal team. We have 16 team members at UH, and 12 of those either got or are getting their degrees at UH. So we have several undergraduate students and several recent graduates who are working on the team. We're partnering with the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory, so they're providing a piece of technology that's going to be integrated into the mission. We also have partners at some smallish technology companies on the mainland who are working on various aspects of the mission. One is a company called Saraniasat, who are kind of taking some of the science lead. Quest, who are helping us with the thermal modeling, and then a company called West Coast Solutions, who are helping us with issues related to how we cool the instrument down when we're in space.
So what's the mission?
So the mission's called HiTi, which is a contraction of hyperspectral thermal imager. So it's the instrument is a long-wave infrared thermal imager. So it measures the amount of light which Earth's surface and atmosphere emits or radiates at 25 different wavelengths or frequencies. So that's like different colors in the invisible part of the spectrum. And with that instrument, we can work out from space the temperature of things on Earth's surface, and we can also work out something about their chemical composition. So that's the instrument. The instrument will be hosted by a 6U CubeSat, so commonly referred to as the bus. So the instrument goes in the 6U CubeSat, and the job of everything which isn't the instrument is to keep the instrument functional. So the CubeSat is 6U, and a U is a unit, which is a volume of 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters. So the spacecraft is going to be 30 centimeters long by 20 centimeters wide by 10 centimeters deep. So it's about the size of a large shoebox. And everything goes in there. There will be a few solar panels which deploy after we're in space, and they're going to capture the sunlight, which is going to power the instrument and the radios and the cooler and the onboard computers. But yeah, so it's a long-wave imaging instrument to detect the, work out the chemistry and temperature of gases in Earth's atmosphere or the solid Earth.
So what are we going to be looking at? What will we be mapping once you get this thing up there?
So we'll be doing a couple of things. One, we'll be looking to make measurements of soil moisture content. So if you take dry soil and you shine the sun on it for a while, then the soil heats up. So we know that when you go out to the beach and your feet get really wet. Your feet get real hot when they're walking on dry sand. If you saturate that soil with moisture, then it's colder. And we know that as well, because when you walk down on the edge of the ocean to get some relief from the hot dry sand, your feet cool down pretty quickly. Now, farmers are interested in how much moisture the soil contains. It tells us lots of things. For example, do we need to irrigate that land? We don't want to waste water. Water is a valuable resource. So we're going to make some measurements of soil moisture content, which will largely rely on the temperature measuring capability of this, of the HiTi instrument. We have a strong interest in volcanic hazards in the Institute of Geophysics and Planetology. So we're going to make measurements around the world of the gases which are being emitted by various volcanoes. So whenever a volcano is about to reawaken from a period of dormancy, fresh magma has to come to the Earth's surface. Fresh magma carries magmatic gases, one of which is sulfur dioxide, so the source of the VOG that we see in Hawaii. And the instrument we have, because of this spectral imaging capability, will allow us to detect the presence of sulfur dioxide at these volcanoes, but also work out how much sulfur dioxide is coming out of the ground.
Right, because unfortunately right now our volcano isn't really pumping like it was last year. Otherwise, we'd be looking at that too.
Well, we will acquire data of Hawaii, but you're right. At the moment, if we want to look at volcanic gases, then Kilauea is not the best place to do it as of today. But there are plenty of volcanoes around the world that will allow us to demonstrate the capability of the instrument to make those measurements.
You're looking at these areas. You're going to collect gases, look at the soil moisture in some of our farmlands, I would imagine. But you're really testing the equipment and the technology.
That's right. So this was funded by NASA via a program called INVEST, which stands for In-Space Validation of Earth Science Technologies. So NASA currently knows how to make these measurements. What we have been funded to demonstrate is, can we make these same measurements using some new and innovative technologies in such a way that we could do it as well but cheaper than it could be done previously? So a regular NASA mission might be $500 million. This entire mission is $5.6 million. It's to demonstrate the capability of new technologies that have recently been invented or developed. So, for example, a key piece of technology in the instrument, as I mentioned, we're going to make measurements of the amount of energy radiated at different frequencies or wavelengths or colors. To do that, you have to take the light that comes in, which is of all wavelengths, and split it into its different wavelengths. So in school, people did this with a prism. You can also do this with filters. If you take a compact disc and flip it over and you see the color of the rainbow, a piece of metal with narrow grooves etched in it will also split light into its different colors. We're not using any of those techniques. We're going to use a technique called interferometry, for which there's a long explanation. Mm-hmm. But the key point is that the key piece of technology was invented by one of the co-investigators on the project, a person called Paul Lucy, who's a member of the faculty in the in HIGP. So we've demonstrated that on various NASA development projects before, and when we wrote the proposal, NASA was interested in demonstrating this in space. The Jet Propulsion Laboratory has recently developed some new detector materials. So after the light has been collected by a lens and has passed through the interferometer, you then have to measure the amount of light at each one of those colors, right? And that's the measurement that you actually use to derive the science data. Those detectors are difficult to make and they're expensive. And JPL has developed a new chemical mixture of materials which allows us to make high-quality measurements potentially for less money. So the new technology from JPL is a new detector chip which is actually going to measure the amount of light that we collect from the ground.
And because UH has been involved in a number of different things related to NASA, how would you characterize this? I mean, how big of a deal is it to have a CubeSat up there?
UH does get a lot of money from NASA for various things. UH has launched a couple of CubeSats before. HSFL currently has a CubeSat which they're doing the final instrument integration in our clean rooms in the basement of the post building. This will be the most capable small spacecraft that UH will have launched in terms of it will be larger than the other couple of CubeSats that we've launched, and the instrument on it will make a larger suite of Earth science-related measurements of the Earth's surface.
Okay, so the largest CubeSat, and then probably just as far as the depth and the breadth of the information that you're trying to glean.
Yeah, we'll be able to answer multiple science questions using this particular instrument suite on this spacecraft.
Okay. Well, gosh, you better get busy, huh?
I was on the phone from about 5 o'clock this morning talking about various aspects of this tour. I've been on 4 other NASA science teams in the past at various stages. But this is the first time that I've been involved in the development from the ground up. You know, so for other science teams, there's one that I'm on. The first science team meeting was held when I was in high school, right? And now I'm on the science team, but mainly in a data analysis capacity. I've been involved in another science team where my involvement began just before launch. So the design had all been done. I was just involved in planning mission operations and then analyzing data. But yeah, this is the first one that I've been involved from T0.
Yeah, way more invested in this.
Yeah. Well, we have to deliver the spacecraft in October 2020. That's basically when we have to put it in a box and ship it off to NASA and say this is good to launch. When it's launched is at the moment not determined. So we have been approved for a CubeSat Launch Alliance launch. So basically we had to put in an application in November of last year. And at the end of that process, we heard from NASA that we've been selected. So what this means is they will find a ride for us, but at the moment we don't know what ride. So the most likely outcome is that we're on a crew resupply mission to the space station. We're taken up to the space station. Some astronauts then put us in a deployment mechanism on the space station, and at some point they shoot us out into space. The solar panels deploy. We start acquiring sunlight so that we can have power. We turn everything on, we check it out, make sure everything's working, and then after we've worked out everything's working, then we turn the instrument on and we start acquiring science data.
That was Rob Wright, the principal investigator of HiTi, an expensive shoebox-sized satellite testing out technology for future long-range NASA missions. Earlier in the show, we quizzed you about the international gig that sent Bob Marley and the Wailers on their first and only tour through Asia and Oceania. Now, their music journey started April 5th, 1979 in Tokyo, the first of 6 sold-out Japanese shows. And music historians credit this event as one of the main reasons why there is such a thriving reggae scene in Japan today. Bob Marley and his family of musicians then hit New Zealand on April 16th and then spent 2 more weeks playing venues throughout Australia. Their final stop on the month-long tour in support of the group's 1978 live album, Babylonia by Bus, was Hawaii. Maui fans flocked to the live show at the Lahaina Civic Center on May 5th, and Bob Marley and the Wailers wrapped the Babylon by Bus tour on May 6th. playing the stage at the Waikiki Shell. Congratulations to Deborah from Haiku Maui. You got it right. That's our quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to the St. Andrews Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
Scores of baby seabirds from Papahanao Makuakea traveled 1,300 miles on an airplane bound for Oahu's North Shore this spring. The rescue mission involved birds at risk because of sea level rise. The rescue chicks include black-footed albatrosses and two types of petrels. Take a listen to a day in the life of wildlife biologist Leilani Falk. Now, that was the sound of preparing a fish smoothie for the youngest residents of the Wildlife Preserve. Now, the restaurant-grade recipe includes several types of fish and squid, as well as salmon oil and electrolytes. It makes for a long day for Leilani and other staffers who are working to give the chicks a fighting chance at survival. You see, the seabird parents normally forage for food and then regurgitate the contents of their stomachs into the mouths of their hungry chicks. Thus, the necessary high-powered blenders, you know, like the Vitamix and Blendtec or the Ninja variety that you may have in your kitchen. We went along on part of a public tour at the James Campbell Wildlife Refuge on Oahu's North Shore. Here's Leilani Falk with an update on the chicks, some of which who have flown the coop.
The bone and petrel chicks, they're pretty much still on an everyday basis. When we get little birds, we like to get them stabilized. So what we mean by that is we want to make sure that if they have any problems inherited, so when we pick up chicks, we don't always know what chicks we're picking up and what problems that they're going to have. Just because they have good weights, good wing cords, and good behavior doesn't mean they're necessarily going to be healthy. So the first couple weeks are really critical, and so we like to feed the chicks every day, not just to get a consistent feed in them, but also every day we do a health check to make sure that everything's on track.
Now, the bone and petrels, they're much larger birds than the Tristan petrels, right?
Yes, that is true. To give an idea, some of our tristrums, they came in at like 126 grams, I think was one of our averages. One of our bone and petrel chicks came in over 300 grams.
Okay. So now the actual feeding of these chicks, the storm petrels, they have little tiny beaks.
They do. They have the tiniest beaks. If you were to probably cut your pinky into a third, that might be about how long their bill is.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Yes.
So it's pretty intensive.
So we have to have also very specialized tools then while we're feeding them. And so each bird has a different size, too, based on their personal body size.
I mean, you're like a neonatal nurse, really.
It feels like that so often. We currently have a chick that came in with a congenital issue. So he has, we think it's something neurological. But he had a hard time with his right leg. So what we had to do is we had to give him a splint. We're actually doing physical therapy with him every day to try to build up those muscles so he'll be good to go.
So this is really intensive care.
It is. It is. I mean, these guys, when we pick them up, a lot of them are only 20 days old. And so it's like taking a 20-day-old baby and you becoming their parent. So you inherit all the intensive care. Even more so with these guys because they develop much faster than humans do. And so they're cramming in all that intensive care time into a very small window.
So now,
they are a lot to do.
So you had that first group of Tristram Storm Petrels come in, oh gosh, that was more than a month ago. But how are they doing? Have some of them matured enough so they're out on their own?
Yes. Oh, I love that. So Tristram Storm Petrels, most of them are actually out at sea right now. So they came in the first week of April, and we have 5 out of the 42 left.
Impressive.
Yes. So everybody, almost all of them are out at sea. So we still have 5, and it's like the youngest birds that are left. So we anticipate that they'll be going in the next couple of weeks.
So I imagine your staff must just be all like proud mamas on Mother's Day. Like, wow, we did it. They're on their own. They're strong enough. They've got the wind beneath their wings.
That is one of the happiest moments for our job, is knowing that we got those guys out healthy, out into the ocean, and that they have the best shot possible. Mostly because with wild populations, I think the average success rate is like 30 to 50. And since we have over 90% success rate, no matter what happens, whether they return to us or not, these guys have a really good chance of succeeding.
Now, when I was out there, I saw that you had, I think it was the black-footed albatross in their little hut. So have you had to build additional ones for the bottom petrels?
Oh, that's a great question. So the albatross and petrels, they have very different natural history. So albatross, they sit and nest above land. With the bone and petrels, Tristram Storm petrels, they are a burrowing species, so we had to make custom burrows for them. So they do have custom housings that we did have to make, but you just can't see them from above ground.
Explain to our listeners why we have had this rescue effort going on. Why do we bring these little chicks in?
That is a great question. And the most simple answer is because they're in a very precarious position. The way I like to describe it to people that come out to our site is you can imagine your house is within 2 meters of the ocean's edge. So 2 meters pretty much of the high tide point. Not necessarily the safest spot for a house. We have, anytime we'd have a king tide event, a tsunami, a hurricane, any sort of storm surge, tropical storms, your house is going to get washed away, and that is the actual reality for the majority of these individuals. The black-footed albatross, Tristram Storm Petrel, and Bonin Petrel really like to be within about 2 meters of the ocean's edge, which means that these guys are really at risk of having not only their nest destroyed, but the chicks drowning every year due to the effects of climate change and sea level rise. And a lot of people, when they hear those things, they just think like oceans rising, you know, like 1/8 of an inch each year. That's not that big of a deal. But when you add that up over 20 or 50 years, you're talking about feed that is gone where these guys used to nest. Also, another thing a lot of people don't think about is the increased storm intensity and frequency that associates climate change. Just to give numbers to people who may not be aware, in 2011, when the tsunami hit the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, on Midway, 56% of the nests were lost from one event. So if we keep having events like that are happening, then these populations are going to continually be cut and cut and cut until the populations that are left won't actually be genetically functioning.
And that is a pretty drastic number. And these are,
it is.
Are they endangered birds? What is the status?
That's a great question. And we're actually trying to prevent them from getting to that point. So the black-footed albatross, Tristram Storm Petrel, are both classified as near threatened on the IUCN. So that's what we use to measure, I guess, where their population status actually is.
Okay. So how long have we been doing this, this rescue effort?
It is an SOS. We started in 2015 with our translocations. It started off with Laysan albatross. And it's a little bit revolutionary in the Hawaiian Islands. Translocations really got started in New Zealand. And so bringing that technology over here, you know, everybody's a little bit hesitant to jump on the bandwagon when they don't know what the success is going to look like. But after our 100% success that first year, we've been able to just continually build. So in 2015, we had 10 birds. This year, we had over 140.
Wow, that's pretty impressive that you've been able to increase the load like that. How soon before the albatross and the Bonin petrels get out the door?
So the Bonin petrels, one of our oldest birds, could actually go within the next week, maybe 10 days or so. So we're pretty excited for them to start leaving as well. And the last Bonin petrel, we estimate, will leave around like the 20th of June. For our albatross, they are a species that needs intensive care. So we picked them up in the middle of February, and they are getting cared for all the way until like the last week of June. So and that magic window changes every year depending on personal bird weights. Also depends on weather conditions. So we have our fingers crossed that the third or fourth week of June, all the albatross will be out the door.
So what are you going to do with yourself?
I think everybody on the team is going to take a month hiatus and just take time off. And then we start prepping for our translocations over on Kauai.
Wow. Okay. So you don't have too much time to rest because you'll be busy.
Exactly. Yep. So we do black-footed albatross, Tristan storm petrel, bone and petrels on Oahu. And then we do Newell shearwater and Hawaiian petrel over on Kauai. And those guys are both classified as critically endangered and endangered.
And will that take you through the rest of the year?
Yeah, that'll take us through December. And then come January, we come right on back and start over again.
Okay. Well, you better eat your Wheaties. Thanks so much, Leilani, for your time. I mean, my gosh, when you were saying you were going to be done with feeding at one, I was like, holy moly, you've been up for a long time.
They need a lot of love.
Yes,
but
yes.
It's definitely worth it, especially if we're going to help these birds and secure their populations in the future. The work's not a problem. We're happy to do it.
All right. Well, thank you for what you do.
Well, thanks. And thanks for having me. It was great chatting with you.
The Rescue Chick Project is a joint effort between the James Campbell Wildlife Refuge, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and the Pacific Rim Conservation, the Department of Defense, and the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, and the David and Lucille Packard Foundation. The James Campbell Refuge will offer public tours of the preserve to see the shorebirds starting in October. The open house tours for the seabirds will pick up again next spring. For links, go to hawaiipublicradio.org. That's it for this week. We'll see you back after the Memorial Day holiday. Call our TalkBack line or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you want to hear today's show again or get another past show or links to more information, go to the conversation page on the HPR website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Our program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Congruspe. The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.